Hey, 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 I'm Al Ledson, and you are listening to First Coast Connect. It's Friday, so that means it's the media roundtable. Some of the items on the menu: Gateway Jack's $2 billion plan for North Core, then proposed food and beverage tax to help fund homeless initiatives was withdrawn. Another death at the jail, this time under NAPCARE. Mayor Deegan appoints Michael Facker as general counsel. We'll see how that works out. And then later, what to expect at the Jack's Book Fest. It's a full show today, so let's get it. Joining me today at the roundtable, we've got Jack Webb, regular contributor and former city council president. Jack, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, my friend. Thank you very much.
Tim Gibbons, editor-in-chief of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Tim, this is the first time we've been on together, right?
I think I caught in once. First time in person.
All right. Well, hey, we're going to have a good time today, then. Dan Scantlin, our own Clark Kent, flying in from a concert last night. Buddy, you look like you stayed out late last
night. But I'm awake. I have caffeine. Thank
I know.
You.
I'm just messing with you. He absolutely looks like Clark Kent today, as he does every day.
I forgot my glasses. Sorry.
I know. It's all good. And on the phone, my man with the plan, Nate Monroe, columnist for the Florida Times Union, who will not bring his baby into the studio for these things. I don't understand it. Nate, how are you?
I'm good, man. I dreaded this because I initially responded and said, I think I can be there in studio tomorrow, and then realized we have these like swim lesson things in the morning that throw off our schedule a little bit. And I was like, oh no, Al's going to give me some. No,
you know what? I'm not going to get this. You. I'm not going to get you because I remember those days. Thank God they are long past me, but I remember those days. So I'm going to let you have your peace today. I'm just going to say you're always welcome to bring the baby. It will make for an exciting show. Listeners at home,
make it happen.
All right. I'm going to hold you to it. Listeners at home, you can join the conversation by calling us at 549-2937. Tweet us at FCC on air, First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can find us at Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, all the places you know where to look for us. Just hit us up and let's dive in. So our top story on Wednesday, Gateway Jacks announced plans for a $500 million mixed-use development in the North Core area of downtown Jacksonville. Over the next 10 years, the build-out could expand across 22 acres and tack up a price tag of $2 billion. Tim, we were talking a little bit earlier before we came on air, and it's really apparent that you have your head wrapped all around this subject. So we're going to go to you first. What do you think?
So it's a huge project and could have a truly transformational impact on that part of Jacksonville. You know, a lot of the focus when we talk about downtown development, rightly so, is basically right around where we're sitting. It's the Jaguars project and all of that. But downtown Jacksonville can't bet it all on just one project. It needs some smaller projects. JWB, who's involved with this project, has been doing things spread across the urban core. There's other developments in the works. But this is on par with Water Street in Tampa. You know, some of the big, massive mixed-use developments in places like Nashville. It truly is a step up if it gets done, which I've been covering development in Jacksonville for long enough that the if it gets done is always the question. But, you know, signs are really good for this one.
Yeah. Earlier you were talking about how you had a folder of all the projects that were supposed to happen in Jacksonville.
Yeah, you know, the city council member referred to this, not the first, as, you know, Jacksonville being the place where projects go to die, or, you know, where renderings are done more often than projects are. And that is an issue. Now, the big difference, and this is, frankly, why I'm most excited about this project, is the involvement of DOP Capital. Based in St. Augustine, started up north, came here about 6 years ago. Fast-growing company. Having an impact on multifamily development across the country, and they got money. So the issue with development now is banks aren't lending. If you're trying to do a project, you can't get the funding. And every other time Jacksonville has had some momentum going, it hits this point in the cycle where the money dries up and the projects don't happen. And then when the money starts flowing again, work begins again, and we kind of start out not exactly back at you know, ground zero, but close to it. With DOP's involvement, with the funding there, they they can actually get the project done. They can actually get the project started. They can get this moving. And then when money frees up again, Jacksonville will already be somewhere.
Yeah. Dan, do we know exactly where they're talking about starting this development at?
Well, part of this is it's basically between the First Baptist Church properties and the 7-Eleven, and they're across the street from FSCJ and places like that. It really is a wasteland right now of parking lots. There's not much there, and the only new development that I can think of really is the 7-Eleven, and that goes back a number of years. You know, Tim is right. I came here in the 80s, and the big project was the shipyards, when the shipyards were still there, and it all went fizzle. And now, finally, 40 years later, we're developing all the shipyards property. We finally have a plan for Lot J, and that took two or three tries and around. And finally, this looks to have the money. And let's not forget, we've got University of Florida planning that wonderful project. Don't know where it's going to be, but FSCJ would love to have it sort of next to them, which would put this across the street from that, across the street from FSCJ, and right on the cusp of what should be a really well-developed Springfield as the homes and some businesses there get going.
Yeah, I was just about to say, so basically we're talking about that area of downtown that's kind of the corridor into Springfield. Where does this include the place that it used to be an old hotel, then it got knocked down, and I think the only thing that's standing is the parking structure.
Heart of Jackson, and that's owned by someone else, and they're planning some development, and the previous owner to that was planning some development. We have yet to be able to get them to respond. It's across the street. It's across.
Across the street and down the street. So no, that property isn't involved. But what you're pointing out is that part of downtown just has stuff going on. I mean, you have Corner Lots development on First and Main is going to be massive. You have a plan for more apartments on 7th Street, further up Main Street. You have, as the Jaguars do stuff here, that's going to bleed into the east side. So it kind of, if you look at a map of Jacksonville, it's that it's kind of following Hogan's Creek, where you have the heart of downtown, the central business district, then you have North Core, then you get into Springfield, and all of the development is going there. Then you get things like the Emerald Trail coming online. That's going to supercharge development, and it's going to connect a lot of these projects in a way that makes it walkable, that makes it, a place where UF students could walk to somewhere and meet up with FSCJ students and then go and get, breakfast at the Bakehouse on Main Street sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tim, you were saying before we went on the air, this the shipyards or whatever, the stuff going down by the stadium can't carry everything as far as development goes. As I said before, it does appear that Jacksonville, for the first time ever, has got five, six, seven major deals going on in downtown. So as I coined the phrase before, we've apparently reached our developmental adolescence.
You're so optimistic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I said before, I was a city council, so I've been around for a while. It's Jacksonville, good ideas come to die, right? Go to die. Like you said, you've got a desk full of rendering. But this seems to be a little bit more. It reminds me of when I came to Jacksonville in 93 after law school, what was going on at the beaches, right? Jacksonville Beach was the blighted area, right? Yeah. All of a sudden, we're running out of beachfront space, right? Florida is growing up. And so people are starting to discover Jacksonville. There's a lot of opportunity here. A lot of money's coming here, which is wonderful. And I give a shout out to Lori Boyer, the Downtown Investment Authority. That was a brainchild, I think, of the Peyton administration, and it's working. It's working.
Yeah, that was actually created under the Brown administration. Civic Council.
Well, I think John Peyton thought of it, but then
I mean, it is a necessary thing for downtown.
Question I have is that it feels like it pulls development a little bit closer to the stadium of downtown development specifically. Like it feels like it pulls it closer to the stadium and less away from what we would call the urban core. Do you think that's accurate?
I think there's an interesting question of where does the development play out and who's hurt and who's helped. I mean, the other downtown writ large fight has been over a gas station being built in La Villa that part of the reason that people are upset about it is it felt like La Villa was a blank slate where you could do true urban development, and the gas station there was a little more of a suburban sort of feel to it. And then you have all the issues with the stadium. How does that affect out east? How do the people there benefit from the money being put in? So I think that is the big question of downtown Jacksonville development, is not just where does it happen, but who benefits from a human standpoint, not from the business standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I think that, you know, I've seen developments all over the country, not just in Jacksonville, but all over the country. And they promise, the developers always promise, that they're going to find a way to work in like low income residences.
They do like saying that.
They like saying that. And in actuality, seeing it actually materialize, it's, I don't know. I mean, I'm not being scientific about it, but I think it's few and far in between. Given that we have a housing crisis.
Yeah, it's interesting. My office sent an inquiry yesterday about that very issue. The developer came back and said, undetermined at this point.
Yeah.
So that's something that definitely needs to be addressed. It gets into the politics of it as well.
It does. Still do remember that Jacksonville has, as much as rents have gone up, the housing costs here, and I'm not downplaying at all the affordable housing crisis that we have, but, you know, rents are lower here than in peer cities. They're rapidly going up. That won't be true, you know, for long necessarily. But the issue here really is we don't have enough housing. There's a lot of people moving in. There's not enough houses for them. And, you know, Econ 101, not enough of a supply. Mm-hmm. You know, you end up with prices going up. So one of the ways, and there are other ways, and we'll talk about the tax that didn't happen, but there are other things that need to be done to deal with homelessness and affordable housing. But one of the ways is to just build more apartments. Housing permits jumped last month for the first time in a while. That's a good sign. It's good that we have more housing stock coming online.
And don't forget that this week there was an announcement that three blighted motels are going to be turned into micro suites, as they're called, $1,000 for rent. And those motels needed to be redeveloped into something that's cleaner.
What side of town are those?
South side, off Bay Meadows Road and off I-95 in University. But still, that's a nice idea to make micro suites, and the renderings look lovely.
What was the response of the mayor and the city council to this?
Deegan was at you're talking about Gateway?
Yeah,
Deegan was at the press conference where it was unveiled. I mean, they're supportive of it. I mean, but I mean, if you're in the political establishment and you have people who are, by and large, putting their own money into a project like this, you would expect them to be to be supportive. They will be going for incentives. You know, obviously, any project like this in Jacksonville's development cycle is going to go for incentives, but they have the rest of their capital stack pretty well established, and that's really important.
Speaking of housing, Monday, the City Council Rules Committee withdrew a proposal that would impose a 1-2% tax on food and beverages sold by businesses such as hotels and restaurants. The additional funds were sought to aid homeless initiatives across the city. Do we know who proposed this bill?
I think it was Jimmy Peluso, was it not? Was he not the sponsor?
It was Jimmy Peluso and Michael Boylan co-sponsored it.
Okay.
Nate, what ways would these funds have aided homelessness initiative?
I mean, I think the kind of main point was that this was a potential tool and a sustainable funding source that could have been used in a lot of different ways. I think the advocates of this plan kind of deliberately did not get too specific, because part of their argument was, look, this is a bill, this is legislation that is necessary for us to ask the legislature to allow us to later levy a tax, right? So, I mean, I think they were trying to not get too far ahead of the debate. That didn't really work. I think it probably best viewed at this point as a tool that they wanted on the table, and it's not going to be on the table now.
You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air. First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You know where to find us. Reach out. We want you to join the conversation. To your point, Nate, do you think that the lack of specifics is part of the reason why it was pulled?
No, I just think that this city council in its current composition is not a council that is eager to pass any kind of tax or fee increase. We've had a few in the last few years, both on the city side and on our public school side. And I even absent those things, I don't think these guys would go for a tax increase. And I think it was, as I read the debate, just kind of a bunch of fear mongering about taxes. And that's why it was pulled. I mean, I don't think it was even necessarily specific to homelessness or homelessness initiatives. In fact, some of the council members not in support of this seemed pretty sort of self-aware of about the fact that they might be perceived as shooting down help for, you know, our homelessness problems. So, I mean, I just think it's a simple matter of the council not wanting to pass a tax increase.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think Nate's dead on in that regard. I mean, anytime you mention the millage rate in Jacksonville, people go into palpitations. So any sort of discussion of tax increase, whatever the source of the revenue is met with stern resistance. But what I found interesting about this particular bill was it was actually bipartisan. You got Michael Boylan from Mandarin and yeah. Jimmy Peluso, a Democrat.
I was thinking that like it seems like a very opposite perspectives.
Perhaps. I thought that was positive, to be perfectly honest with you. I thought it was, it's kind of like, as Nate was saying, this was kind of like more of a placeholder. I remember years back when we had to do something about indigent health care, we had to go to Tallahassee and get approval for, you know, get the legislature to approve a local tax or whatever. And it failed, much like this one did. I don't want to say this was necessarily a placeholder, but it was kind of it did define the issue, though. And I think it opens the door for additional dialogue as to, you know, what are the needs? You know, let's define the needs and what is the funding source? What are we going to do to address the situation?
We talk about downtown development, and I think there is a clear and obvious need for a dedicated funding, you know, a persistent funding source to deal with the homelessness issue. I will say, talking to enough restaurant owners, though, a really hard time to be a restaurant owner. I mean, post-COVID, frankly, the business has not come back. The breakfast and brunch places actually have kind of bounced back. But if you're a higher-end restaurant, your food costs have gone up, your labor costs have gone up, hiring people is difficult, and they will say, oh, and yes, they're talking their own book, I get that, but they will say that anything, just 1% more added to a bill is going to hurt their bottom line. And it's not a high-margin business. It's a tough business. And in some ways, they're a sympathetic group when you say, you know, we're going to raise taxes. And they're like, no, don't. They can sway public opinion because, you know, it is a hard thing that they're doing. So, it was a fight that I'm not actually surprised that those opposed to the tax won. But I will say there needs to be a dedicated source because that's how we deal with
right.
the problem.
Yeah,
to be clear, we like this term dedicated funding source in the town. That means tax. Like that is it's a euphemism for tax. Mm-hmm. There is no other thing that can be a dedicated source except a tax. Anything less than that is just, you know, the council can set discretionary spending year after year for things, but that's not dedicated. That could change at any moment. So like just, you know, we love to deploy that term, but it means a tax. So just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah. To Tim's earlier point, we had a roundtable here with restaurant owners in the downtown core, and we didn't talk about this tax specifically, but we talked about the trials and how hard it is for them to keep their business going. I mean, you know, one of my favorite restaurants went out of business, Black Sheep, specifically because everything is going up in cost. So I do think it's fair for them to flag the fact that this tax would hurt them. But then to Nate's point, the only way we can get through this issue and try to figure something out is if there is a dedicated source, which as Nate so eloquently said, is a tax. So is there anything else before the city council that we know of where they're looking for ways to address this issue?
Well, the last council passed the bill that prohibits you to actively stand on a median and do things, and that mainly is aimed at people who are trying to get money, or like the guy I see almost all the time, who is weaving these crosses made out of, you know, palm leaves.
Which is a dedicated footnote.
Yeah. And I have seen less people standing on medians, but it's still there. So I don't know if JSO is actually out there citing, but that is a negative attempt to control.
Right. That law is specifically to cater to people who have homes, right? What I'm asking is there any movement to help people who are unhoused right now? Because clearly we can see
not beyond the same stuff the city's been doing for years. I mean, much like in the development world with renderings, the city is very, very good at putting out impressive, exciting reports that then just never really get acted on. And that's kind of where this issue is.
Mike from Twitter said, rent is still too high and residents are eagerly waiting for proposals on how to deal with the problem. Again, like, this is not a scientific survey that I've done, but I know that we're in a housing crisis, and yet when I drive through different parts of town, I see for rent signs up everywhere. So I'm wondering if Mike is like hitting on the exact thing that like we are in a housing crisis, but also the rents are high and people can't afford it because wages haven't gone up in like forever, right? So like if the rents go up and you're still making the same thing that you were making, you know, 8 to 10 years ago, how are you going to afford it? And so the question is, what is the city council going to do to, and the mayor's office, to address that?
And that's part of the problem, is that it is a complicated sort of thing. So if you talk to landlords, you know, one of the reasons rents are going up is because property insurance is going up. So, you know, that seems like we're talking about homelessness and rents and property insurance. You know, there's a whole line there, and you can't adjust this one dial.
Right.
You know, so when people say deal with homelessness, to some extent what they're saying is the state has to do more to deal with the property insurance market, because that can trickle into actually rents being lower or more properties being developed or things that increase the housing stock that will deal with homelessness. So
if that, in fact, is the case, I mean, again, I mean, the market is the market. We got more people coming to the state. We got more people coming to the city, right? So Dan said it before, we don't have enough housing, right? So, again, it's a basic supply and demand. I mean, the cost will go up, and it begs the question. I mean, when we're – and I think maybe that was one of the issues that arose with this particular bill, was just the, you know, again, what are we funding? Homelessness. Okay. All right. Great. Let's define what we're actually talking about. Is it affordable housing? Is it getting people off the medians? I don't know. I mean, these are issues that we would have to address from a policy perspective before any definitive legislation was enacted. So.
And Clay County, as well as Jacksonville, both enacted those medians to try to, I believe, stop homeless people from being out on the street. Don't forget, too, that if you start charging a 2% tax on food and you don't have tourists, you don't get a lot of money. St. Augustine, St. John's County, that's a tourist-based economy. Sure. Here, I don't know, you'd be hitting Joe Sixpack, who's going out to dinner with the family.
Yes. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air, First Coast Connect at wjct.org. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and on YouTube. So, Tuesday, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office announced the death of an inmate at the Duval County Jail. This marks the 12th death this year and the first since the new private health care contractor, NapCare, took over. Nate, what are you hearing about this story?
Well, I mean, in some ways, this particular story kind of touches on a couple of different issues. The man who died was homeless and was also there because of a misdemeanor trespassing charge. Those are kind of wrap in a couple of different issues. The sheriff was actually on this show that very day the death was announced, kind of downplaying the idea that JSO locks up people for misdemeanors for significant amounts of time. And that kind of same breath also defended his kind of obstinance about an adult civil citation program, about implementing one here, just a way of diverting some people from going to jail for nonviolent offenses. And so, like, it was kind of a, the timing of it was interesting. Mm. I mean,
we would absolutely love for the sheriff to come back and talk to me about all of these issues.
And actually, that death occurred on Monday. They did not release the news until Tuesday. And so the sheriff sitting here with me did know about it. His comment, though, was specifically that most of these misdemeanor cases, they're out of jail the next morning. Well, not according to this poor gentleman who was in there for 2 weeks.
Yeah, this guy was there for 13 days. Yeah.
Which,
13 days.
Which blows me away. I mean, he's awaiting trial on a misdemeanor trespass charge. I mean, we got people being released crossing the border seeking amnesty. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but they're being released. And we got a guy that we're paying the cost of housing. Why are we holding this guy for 2 weeks for a trial? Give him a citation. Give him a notice to appear. But, you know, the fact that it's under NAFCARE is, you know, I don't know if it's just a raw issue right now with healthcare at the jail. And again, this is another tragic death at the jail, you know, 12th this year. But what happened? I mean, I want to see the video, right? What happened? The guy is seen moving around his cell at 10 o'clock, come back 2 hours later, and he's under the bunk and he's unresponsive. What happened that two-hour period? I mean, was there any diagnosis of any health issue? Was he under meds? I mean,
we have not received any more information on this case at this point. Again, let's not forget the sheriff did indicate that they're aware of NAFCARE's shortcomings. So in this case, this new contract comes with some eyes open. Mm-hmm. So I like to say in a year, let's see what happens.
The sheriff said that adults who make adult decisions get adult prizes when questioned about adult citations. I would just once again like to say that I would love to have a conversation with the sheriff, but he won't speak to me. So the chair is open anytime.
What do you mean? He touts how transparent he is. I can't believe that. Why wouldn't he come on the show and talk to
it's,
you?
I mean, you know, I don't know. You'd have to ask him, but I would love to have a conversation with him. And Dan did a great job talking to him, but I have some questions that I would like to ask. We've got a caller on the line, Todd on the South Side. Todd, how are you today? And thank you for talking to me.
Good morning to everyone on the panel. Yes, I wanted to make a comment, and it would take some time to explain to everybody why he won't talk to you, but I think I have a good idea. T.K. Waters, the sheriff, was on, and he said that we really don't have any racial issues in Jacksonville. I don't know if I'm quoting him correctly, but my question is, that's pretty a dangerous thing to say. If he doesn't have a police unit dealing with the white supremacist groups in this area, we've got a real serious problem. He's got a gang unit, drug unit. Where is the unit to deal with the question of white supremacy and the different organizations that exist in Jacksonville?
Todd, thanks so much for your question. I would just say that, like, with the reporting that I have done on issues of white supremacy, I'm actually working on a story right now with the other show I host, Reveal. And the idea of law enforcement not taking white supremacy serious is not just confined to this city. It's a national thing. One of the stories that I'm working on right now is about the protests that happened in Denver after George Floyd's death, and the FBI had planted an informant in the racial justice movements, which were, you know, by and large peaceful until this informant riled it up. But they had no idea what was going on in groups like the Proud Boys around that time as well. And then soon after, you know, January 6th happened. So I think that, you know, what Todd has identified is not a local thing. It's a national thing where we tend to not put as much attention as needed on these white supremacist movements. And I think January 6th is a clear reminder of that, because that is a monumental failure of intelligence on the part of the FBI and other national agencies. We're going to go to Tom in the West Side. Tom, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How about yourselves today?
I'm just so glad that you called in to talk to me.
Oh, excellent. I just wanted to say that what I get from the article I read on Mr. Givens and his arrest is it seems like the jail was the wrong place for him to be anyway. What I took away from the article was that this was a man dealing with severe mental health issues and probably should have been in the hospital, which CAMHS does have a mental health unit, and or MHRC. And the last place he should have been in was the jail. So he definitely should not have died in jail.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much for calling. I'll give it to our panel. Dan?
Well, according to the Tributary and other media sources, he was in a hospital complaining of hip pain and refused treatment and then apparently hung around for whatever reason we don't know. And that's where the trespassing charge came from. So, again, not to indicate what his state of mind was at the time, but he was in a hospital. And if he'd stayed there, possibly there would have been some mental health resources applied at said hospital.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, that's what the story said. He was seeking medical care and he was trespassed out and arrested. I mean, so what medical care did he receive over the 12 days or 14 days, however long he was at Duval County Stockade? I don't know. But it's a great question.
Ongoing investigation. Ongoing investigation. If you were to ask, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
I think one thing that the caller brings up that I think we talked about this last Friday, if I'm correct, but in this society, we expect the police department to do everything, right? Or the sheriff's office to do everything. They're supposed to be mental health counselors. They're supposed to break up domestic violence. They're supposed to blah, 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 all of these things. And it just feels like if we as a city, like really put some thought into how you could shift, change the paradigm from what we are doing currently, where the police are supposed to handle everything, to thinking about, like, if this man has mental health issues, then maybe you don't call the police out for it. Maybe he doesn't go to jail. Maybe he goes to somewhere that's dedicated to helping people like him. I think too many times we tend to think about punishing people instead of thinking about how can we help people.
Amen. I mean, that's been a chronic problem. It's been an ongoing problem here in the city of Jacksonville and nationwide as well. I mean, let's face it. But I remember when Congressman Rutherford was sheriff, I mean, we used to get in annual battles about his budget. And he'd say, Jack, listen, here's the deal. My agency is the largest provider of mental health care services in the county. And so whatever. Yeah.
And we're going to go to the phone. We've got Azeem. Azeem, how are you this morning?
Hi, good morning. I'm an internal medicine resident at UF Health, a third year in my training. I just wanted to make a brief comment because we see these jail patients come to UF quite often. Now, I only see them when many of them do come to the ER, and I'm sure many of them do go back. But I think in my 3 years at UF, there's always a question about whether or not when we treat a patient and we send them back to the jail, what access do they have to medications and antibiotics? And it's not infrequent that sometimes they do come back because of some lapse in their treatment. So I can't really comment on what happened to this gentleman who unfortunately passed away. But one thing that comes to my mind is if he either wasn't given a medication that he was due to be scheduled to be given, or there was a lapse in some kind of care. It's unfortunate that it happened, though.
Azeem, thank you so much for calling in.
You talk about mental health, though. There are three officers who are paired with mental health officials as part of a new program. I think they have another one coming online, and they are assigned to cases where they possibly will divert them to a mental health program. But that, again, that's three officers with three mental health out of 900, 1,000 officers. It's a start. It's a great idea. We were only the second sheriff's office in the state to do that, so I applaud them for that. But perchance you need dedicated teams in each zone, focusing on certain things, and maybe you need a team at SHANS, which UF SHANS, which is, of course, our trauma unit where most of the indigent care goes.
Yeah, interesting. I think we're talking here. It's a confluence between mental health and physical health. We don't really know. As a caller just said, it could have been failure to provide meds. What meds was he on? I mean, we don't know. He was seeking medical care at the hospital. He was trespassed out and arrested. So it's more information.
I mean, the bigger problem here is that the sheriff's office has not been transparent about these deaths beyond acknowledging that they've happened, which is a very low standard. We just don't know a lot about any of these cases, and that's unacceptable. All we know is that there have been a lot. 12 is a lot for a county of this size and for that jail population. Something is deeply wrong, and the city and the city council seem intent on having a discussion about building a new jail that's kind of taking place in a vacuum. Like, they don't want to touch these larger issues. It's like, we just want to talk about getting a new jail. And I think that's a mistake, because jail deaths are not happening because there's not fresh paint on the wall. They're happening because of management and because of the administration and running of the jail. And if you don't address that, if you don't address, as you guys were talking about, our mental health issues, and to some degree, even our homelessness problem, like, all of this is going to be for naught, and we'll end up spending a ton of money building a new jail and just having the same old problems.
Yes. I think that, you know, one thing that I'm always reminded of when I hear about these jail deaths, and a lot of times, I think when you're talking about them, there's a general apathy, because, you know, these are people who have died locked up. And the thing that I'm always thinking about is, but did their crime necessitate a death sentence? And that's what we should be asking. And of course, the answer is no. That, you know, these people are Jacksonville residents. They're Jacksonvillians. That's right, Jacksonvillians, not Jacksons. They're Jacksonvillians, and they should be treated with respect and care. Moving on, Mayor Donna Deegan announced appointment of Michael Fackler. Am I saying that right?
Fackler, yes, sir.
Michael Fackler to the city's general counsel. His nomination follows Randy DeFore's withdrawal from the nomination process. So what do we know about Michael Fackler?
I think he's very qualified. I think it's a good week for the Deegan administration. I think she got a good, she vetted a candidate, took it to the council, vetted it. The administration reviewed him, obviously selected him or chose him, asked him if he'd serve. And took it to council president, took it to the rules chair, and said, "Hey guys, what do you think?" And all right, we're all in. And he's a Democrat. Okay, great. Qualified former federal law clerk, Judge Schlesinger. I did a 2-year gig in the Peace Corps, been practicing law about 20 years. And according to the Times Union, he's Hank Cox's son-in-law, which tells me that the vetting process he experience prior to getting married is probably nothing compared to what he's going to do with the general counsel.
Well, I talked to Ron Sandlin yesterday.
Hey, look, Hank Cox is my buddy. You stay off of Hank. Stay off of Hank.
I know him as Uncle Hank, but that's another story. I talked to the council president, Ron Sandlin, yesterday, and he indicated that this should be a due process when the council gets it after the Fackler is reviewed. But he does not see an issue there. He said, indeed, the council vice president and the rules committee all called Donna Deegan and said he passes muster with us. So, again, you have a guy with 20 years of legal experience, 2 years Peace Corps, lots of major titles and awards. Sounds like a good choice.
Although not board certified in government law, which is the one thing that I would say I
and
would
Salem
like to see
said
in general
that
counsel.
He will probably need an aide to get him through some of that initially, but did not have an issue with
it. I am all for talking about Mr. Fackler's credentials and that he is clearly qualified. But I think we would be amiss by leaving out the fact that Randy DeFore was also clearly qualified. And she did not get through this process. I'm just saying that, like, it's great to talk about his qualifications, but also because if we talk about his qualifications and don't say that, like, Randy DeFore was also qualified, it feels like what we're saying is that she wasn't qualified. That's why she didn't get it. And he is.
Oh, but this issue came up about Randy DeFore, this issue, quote unquote, regarding lobbying.
Yeah, but come on.
Yeah, we know that was a red.
And again, quotation marks.
Nate, any thoughts?
I mean, I think I audibly sighed inadvertently into the phone. Yeah, I mean, the general counsel, this is politics are a part of this disappointment and this decision, like, inherently. And to pretend that qualifications are the only thing that matters is just kind of silly. The general counsel, and to Tim's point, I mean, the general counsel's office, I mean, no attorney coming in from the outside is going to have just a seamless transition into that office. Our government structure is bizarre, and OGC is really at the center of it. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, you are kind of the general counsel. I can't really use a bevy of phrases coming to mind. Like, you're eating a lot of very unpleasant things in that job, and are essentially kind of at the center of every dysfunctional thing that happens. I mean, it's a tough gig, and, you know, it's a fraught position for anybody.
You know, Al, it's interesting. There was a lot of discussion around town, especially in the legal community, who's going to be the next GC. And prior to the election, there was some discussion that the Deegan administration would look outside the city of Jacksonville and do a nationwide search for general counsel. Okay, that didn't happen. And quite honestly, I thought that was a good idea because it was kind of outside the box a little bit. All right, cool. But to Nate's point, I think that we kind of maybe had the best of both worlds here. We got a guy with a lot of upside here and a smart guy who is from Jacksonville, well, been in Jacksonville for a while, and probably understands our form of government, because we do have a funky form of government. He'll pick it up real quick with regards to the complexities of the charter, with the complexities of the independent authorities and things of that nature. And because it's a hard gig, it's a hard job, and there are a lot of herding of cats internally and managing conflicts and things of that nature. So I think it's a we'll see. I will say it is kind of a change in direction for the general counsel, or the general counsel has evolved over time. It used to be you bring in some senior status type guy, right, who's going to serve, whether it's Judge Durden, whether it's Jim Reinemann, Fred Franklin. You come in, you serve for 3 or 4 years, kind of capstone of your career, and you move on. That's not what it is anymore. It's become more a career position, and it's become politicized as well. So hopefully it'll remain career, obviously. That's where we're going here. But hopefully it'll be depoliticized as well.
And you are in charge of one of the largest law firms in the city, 45 staff members, according to their website. And you and those staff members are the legal representative for not only the city council, but city government administrators, all those independent authorities. That's a hefty load with a lot of issues you have to talk about.
Which is a question I think that needs to be examined as well. Is that the right model?
Right. And I think that's part of when you talk about the funky government system, yep. that idea, if you go back and you look at the charter and you look at how the OG, how the general counsel is supposed to be selected, mm-hmm. it is supposed to be that stature position. It's supposed to basically be, you know, the inside arbiter. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to be the senior partner in the general counsel law firm, which is what it's become. It's become an advisor to the mayor sometimes. It's become somebody who's pulling together a lot of different positions. And if you go back to the original idea, it wasn't seen as somebody who's part of the mix of government. They were supposed to be above the fray, and we kind of sort of still act that way. We still let them make those decisions, you know, is it should or would or could sort of things, but they're also in the mix. And that's a hard balancing act. I don't know if it's a possible balancing act.
Mm-hmm. So do we think this go ahead, Nate.
I was going to say, it's an even more fraught balancing act when you have a council and mayor and potentially other branches of government that are butting heads. And it, you know, it seems like fair to predict that the Republican-controlled council and the Democratic mayor are going to be butting heads. That's when the general counsel is put in these very difficult positions. You know, the general counsel is a powerful position. I mean, they get to declare what the law is. And they're, at least theoretically, if they issue a binding opinion interpreting, you know, some ordinance or even a state law in some cases, it's not reviewable by the courts. Like, it's a powerful position. And it just has a lot of controversy attached to it kind of inherently.
So we feel pretty confident that this nomination is going to go through?
I would think so. If you got rules, you know, if you got the committee chairs, they're going to rules, quite honestly, is most important committee assignment, rules chairs on the council, because it's gatekeeper. So, but if you've got the council president, council vice president, and rules committee chair on board, you know, the other cats will.
And the council president did say to me that he believed that this would, under due diligence, make its way through. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is this a new way of kind of working for the Deegan administration, like going through and kind of talking to people before they actually put someone up for nomination?
That's the way it should be, actually. in my mind. I mean, you should get your ducks in a row.
Yes.
If you want to be successful.
And it's about that time. Oh, I love it when a plan comes together. It's our lightning round where I ask all our participants what they got for me. And I will kick it off with my man, Jack Webb. What you got?
I'm just going to take a weekend off and tend my orchids, my friend.
We're working on a story about the business of orchids. It's really weird. It's like...
Dead.
If you happen to be at Fort Clinton for Nandina Beach tomorrow on a nice day and seeing a piece of history, there's a car show inside the fort, which I wrote about for us on WJCT News. I can't be there, but it's a lot of fun. And then you've got lots of acreage of fort and shoreline. It's a wonderful day for the kids and you.
Do any orchids grow on the shoreline?
I don't believe those are aquatic or semi-aquatic bioorganisms, sir.
Nate Monroe, what you got for me?
Well, in case you didn't get your fill of annoying government news, the council will be voting on the budget next week. So we'll be keeping a close eye on that.
And the council meeting starts at 3 o'clock, not 5, because of that.
All right. Thank you to my panelists, Jack Webb, Tim Gibbons, Dan Scanlon, and Nate Monroe for coming to talk to me today. It's been a blast. And we will be right back.
Amelia Island Chamber Music Festival launches its season this November with Royal Wedding cellist Sheku Kane Mason and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis and guest vocalist Ashley Pizzotti. Info at ameliaisland.com/chamber. At Vistar Credit Union, we believe in helping members reach their financial goals and building stronger communities. It's why we offer our members better rates and give back to the places we call home. Vistar Credit Union. Visit vistarcu.org/join.
Can Congress avoid another government shutdown?
Good luck if you want to take a vacation and need your passport renewed.
The clock's ticking, and Republican senators are urging their House colleagues to sort it out.
I'm not a fan of government shutdowns.
Well, thanks to generous supporters like you, the Friday News Roundup is fully funded, at least for another week. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Hey, hey, welcome back. You're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Mal Letson, sitting in the big chair, coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT. And it's Friday, y'all. We made it through the week. Just a few more hours, and then we get to kick our feet up. One of the things that you could be doing this weekend is the Jax Book Fest. It returns to Jacksonville, the public library, for the first time since February 2020. The event takes place today and tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the main library downtown. More than 80 local regional authors and author talks, book signings, and fun for the whole family. Saturday headliners are New York Times bestselling authors Dan Sandlat, Joe Hill, and Angeline Booley. Joining me now is Angeline. She is a New York Times best-selling author. Angeline, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, you did.
Sweet. It's a Friday. I get a prize. Okay, so tell me a little bit about your background prior to your writing career.
I'm Ojibwe, and I always worked for tribes in Michigan. And then I ended up in Washington, D.C. I was the director for the Office of Indian Education at the U.S. Department of Ed.
Nice.
And so I worked in public schools to try to improve public school education for Native students and about Native Americans.
Yeah. So tell me about your because you have two books, right?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me about the first one, how you started writing that, the title of the book, all of that.
Sure. My debut novel, Firekeeper's Daughter, and I had the idea for that when I was 18. I pitched it as Indigenous Nancy Drew meets 21 Jump Street. But I didn't start writing until I was 44, and it took a good 10 years to finish a draft I felt, you know, good about. And then my second book, Warrior Girl Unearthed, and that came out in May, and I pitched it as Indigenous Lara Croft, but instead of raiding tombs, the main character is raiding museums to retrieve ancestral remains and sacred items that do not belong in museums.
Sold. I'm going to get these books like right away. I'm so sorry I haven't read them yet, but these sound amazing. So in your journey as a writer, you know, I know a lot of people who are, you know, older, like in their 40s, and they want to write a book, but they a lot of times they feel like they're just too old, like, you know, that passed them by. Can you tell me about your process and how you just you did it?
I just had this wake up moment. Maybe it was midlife crisis. I'll own that. And it was like, I've always talked about writing this story. What am I waiting for? And I just decided that I could write the world's worst first draft, and I could live with failure easier than I could live with the regret of never trying.
Yes. Yeah. And so it took you 10 years.
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously the second one was a lot quicker.
Yeah, I had 1 year to write that.
Yeah, yeah. Was that because you had the pressure to do it quick, or
I was on deadline.
Yeah. Deadline will make you do amazing things.
The sophomore novel, probably a lot like a sophomore album or sophomore film, like that second effort is that really tests your skill and your ability to become a different type of creative and be able to create on deadline.
Yeah. There are, a lot of some of my favorite authors are Indigenous, but when talking about, like, you know, writing and storytelling, you know, Indigenous authors a lot of time don't get the spotlight as much. Can you tell us about, like, the Indigenous writing community? Just I'm just trying to help the listeners, like, find new authors and new stories, because, oh my goodness, like, we get a recycle of a lot of the same stories, right? And every time I read an Indigenous author, it just feels like it's taking me to a completely different world.
Exactly. I think that, you know, we've always had great storytellers in our Indigenous communities, but we weren't the ones getting the book deals.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, publishing has kind of had a reckoning over the past few years that, you know, Indigenous storytelling is best served by, you know, being told by Native storytellers telling the stories from their communities. And I had a mantra while I was writing, and it was, I write to preserve my culture and I edit to protect it. And I think that's one key thing about Native authors, that we know when to pull that curtain and what not to share.
Yeah. I interviewed many years ago Joy Harjo, and she basically said the same thing. It's like, you know, there are things that we should talk about out loud, and there are things that maybe we should hold back and hold for ourselves. That just really stuck with me all of these years. So you're speaking tomorrow at 10:30. What can we look forward to from your talk?
I will be sharing a little bit about my journey, you know, this 38-year path to publication, and what my life's like now as a full-time author, and where things are going now. I did sell the film rights to the Obamas, their studio Higher Ground Productions. They're interested in the project for Netflix. And so it's just been wonderful. I love the opportunity to talk with people who love books and, you know, love to talk about writing, and especially younger writers.
Yeah. Angeline Booley, New York Times bestselling author. She is going to be at the Book Fest at the main library this weekend. Go see her. Go read her books. It's going to be an incredible event. And that is the end of our show today. Thank you, everybody, coming in. Angelon, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Miigwech. Thank you for having me.
All right. I'm Al Ledson. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Our executive producer is music maestro David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey the Brain Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer and our Steven Spielberg of the operation, Brady Corum. All right, y'all. Have a good weekend, and I will see you on Monday. And remember, keep your heart open for Duval and each other.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.